Today on Against the Grain, it's easier to remember the histories of defeat than those of social transformation. But in the 3 years preceding the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile, the country experimented with a form of socialism that was both top-down and bottom-up. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with historian Marian Schlotterbeck about how under Salvador Allende's government, the radical left fueled changes at the grassroots, including through popular assemblies, and altered, for a few years, expectations about the possible. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. On September 11, 1973, the Chilean military, led by Augusto Pinochet and supported by the United States, overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. The 17 years of dictatorship that followed were brutal, and they've managed to erase much of the historical memory about what came before them. That is, what took place during those 3 years of Allende's popular unity government. In Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile, published by UC Press, Marian Schlotterbeck attempts to bring to life the spirit of revolution and social change on a popular level that characterized the 1,000 days of Allende's government. While the popular unity government often preached moderation, it unleashed radical changes from the bottom up. Schlotterbeck is assistant professor of history at UC Davis, and she joins me now. Marian, what were the currents of the traditional left in Chile?
So in 1970, Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile. He was a member of the Socialist Party. He was a committed Marxist. And he was a perennial presidential candidate. He was in no way a sort of new actor on Chile's political scene. And this in large part came about because starting the late 19th century, Chile had a very strong labor movement that came out of the northern nitrate mines and the southern textile and coal mining communities. And that militant leftist labor movement allied itself to the emergent political parties that represented the working class. And those were the Communist Party and the Socialist Party of Chile. And so across the 20th century, the goal of those two parties was eventually to take state power through engaging in electoral politics. That is the idea that the working class could be represented within the political system. And that's what Allende's victory represented in 1970. It might have shocked the world, but it was part of a decades-long strategy by the left in Chile to take power through peaceful means.
Tell us something about Chilean society, let's say in the mid to later 20th century.
Sure.
Chile was regarded as a sort of more middle-class country than some in Latin America. What did the society look like, and kind of and what were the forces politically and economically, socially?
In Chile, they used to joke prior to 1973 that politics was practiced as a sport. Everybody had their team, and everybody was a partisan of their team. And Chilean politics typically broke down into what were called the three thirds. There was the right, there was the center, represented by the Christian Democratic Party, a fairly new political actor in the 1950s, and the left, which represented primarily the Socialist and Communist Party, as well as smaller leftist factions. Chile had a fairly large urban population, largely concentrated around Santiago, the capital, and then the sort of industrial port cities of Valparaiso and Concepcion. While workers had had a lot of political rights since the 1930s, rural workers had been systematically excluded from those same rights to unionize and organize. And that's what started to change in the 1960s as Chile's political system opened up to include more actors.
And so what did that look like in the 1960s?
So really the period that begins with the 1964 election of Christian Democrat Eduardo Frei, who promised a sort of centrist revolution in liberty, a sort of middle-class revolution that was in large part bankrolled by the U.S. government. This was Kennedy's vision for the Alliance for Progress to sort of stave off the threat of communist revolution like the 1959 Cuban Revolution by supporting sort of improving standards of living across the continent. The U.S. government saw it couldn't just keep supporting the same oligarchs who'd been in power since the 19th century. And so here in Chile is this new kind of centrist, middle-class, Christian Democratic Party that's formed in the 1950s. And it really became seen as, in the words of one U.S. policymaker, the last best hope for this alternative to the sort of traditional elites associated sort of with the right and a sort of more threatening perception of a sort of potential communist or socialist revolution. And so Eduardo Frei started carrying out a series of progressive but still relatively moderate reforms, things like land distribution, which really had not been touched in Chile really since the sort of independence in the early 19th century. And for a lot of the really traditional landed elites in Chile, that agrarian reform in the 60s was the beginning of the end, not Allende's election. Allende's election was just one more step. And so as much as the Frei government wanted to carry out the sort of very moderate transformation of Chilean society, carrying out reforms, acknowledging that the levels of inequality weren't sustainable, they also raised expectations, and they weren't able to meet those rising expectations, both from rural peasants as well as from the urban homeless poor who were engaged in a series of shantytown land occupations.
So how did the right and the traditional elites respond to these reforms, which you say they saw as sort of the beginning of the end? How did they respond politically to that? We're going to talk about the left, but obviously the reaction and counter-reaction by right and left is central to the story.
One key element of Chilean history is the extent to which there's an authoritarian right that had really been there all along, that doesn't believe in democracy at all. And so when its back is up against the wall, it's going to turn to force, to violent repression, to maintain its hold on the status quo. And so you see that increasingly happen in terms of landowners arming themselves to take back or defend their land from being expropriated or occupied by peasants. You can see this again in the actions of figures like Augustine Edwards, the owner of Chile's largest newspaper, El Mercurio, the actions of segments of ITT in Chile, who directly lobbied through the CIA to try to bankroll a military solution to keeping Allende out of power.
So then, as you say, Allende didn't come out of the blue when he was elected in September of 1970. What was his base of support? Who backed him and what parties came into coalition behind him?
So Allende led the Popular Unity Coalition, and that was composed of the two largest parties, the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, as well as smaller leftist parties, the Christian Left, the MAPU, and sort of other smaller parties came together. But Allende really represented a victory for the workers and for the working class, sort of the non-elite popular sectors of Chile. They really saw his victory as their own. And so beyond just the sort of partisan politics, there was really a massive popular groundswell of support for Allende. And that really began across the 1960s. Chilean society in the 1960s experienced a number of different social movements, from the peasants' movement to the shantytown movement to a very active university reform student movement. And so you see the sort of ways in which society is mobilizing. That kind of brings Allende into power. It wasn't that his election suddenly overnight inspired all these people to mobilize and demand more of their government and to begin carrying out sort of transformations on their own. I think that's actually the kind of the reverse. The movement is what made possible this really striking electoral victory in 1970.
And that said, what did he campaign on? What was his agenda?
So Allende promised a peaceful revolution. It was going to come through the ballot box. He promised to redistribute wealth. He wanted to end foreign control, as well as monopoly control over the Chilean economy. And he wanted to deepen democracy by extending things like worker participation in factories, that is, that the workers could actually decide what they would produce, which which is, again, quite novel as a suggestion in the world in 1970.
And how did his coalition come together? Was it a kind of motley crew or different entities with a pretty similar vision?
Well, Chilean party politics really throughout the 20th century was about coalitions. Right? So in the 1930s and 40s, Chile had a number of successful popular front coalition governments. And so in some ways, Allende's iteration of the popular unity in 1970 is just the reconstituted version of what the Chilean left had been doing all along. Now, that said, because it wasn't a single party, there were, of course, differences between the socialists and the communists. There were differences between those inside and outside Allende's governing coalition, particularly sort of critics from the left.
Well, tell us about that further left. Obviously, the model in Latin America that had dominated it, at least for a long time, may have lost its luster by 1970, but was the Cuban Revolution in 1959, which put forward a model of armed struggle and then revolutionary overthrow of the state. Obviously, what Allende represented was, although a socialist, his vision was one, and his means of getting there, which was quite different. Was there a revolutionary left in Chile that was trying to go the Cuban route? And how was that route seen at that point in 1970?
Great question. So yes, in the 1960s and 1965, in fact, the movement of the revolutionary left, the Movimiento de Izquierda Revolucionaria, was founded in Chile from sort of dissidents from the communist and socialist parties. They drew inspiration from the model of the Cuban Revolution that said socialist struggle will be ushered in through armed struggle. But they also really drew on Chile's much longer tradition of anarchism and labor activism. And so this was a sort of the MIR in its early phase really was a kind of motley crew of this older generation of dissidents from the 1930s and this young generation of the sort of 1960s rebellious youth in the universities who participated actively in the reform movement. And so in the 1960s, as the Christian Democrats, the sort of centrist middle class party, is in power, the MIR did support armed struggle. They sort of didn't say, you know, we've looked at all the models, look how many times Allende's run for office and he never wins. Why are we going to keep supporting the same old tired strategy? And so through the 1960s, that sort of 4 or 5 year period, Chile's revolutionary left did vocally support armed struggle in principle. What really changed for Chile's revolutionary left was Allende's election, because suddenly it opened up the possibility for really effervescent grassroots social struggle. And one of the things that Allende represented when he took office, he was often called the compañero presidente, the sort of people saw him as being on their same level. And he promised that, unlike in the past, state force was no longer going to be used to repress people. And so a lot of different sectors of society saw this as sort of green light to go forward with their vision for change, because the president was behind them, because we were in power. Things were going to be different from before, where so often the police and the military had come in to break strikes, to forcibly evict people from their lands. And so Chile's very small, very new, and very young revolutionary left really had this opportunity to support the most radicalized elements of this grassroots social struggle once Allende was elected in 1970.
I'm speaking with historian Marian Schlotterbeck. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We're discussing her book, Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile. We're talking about the transformations to Chilean society that took place between September of 1970 and of 1973, when Allende was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup. So what did those 1,000 days of Allende's popular unity government, what did they look like on the ground for everyday life? How much was it changed or altered or upended?
I often think about the ways in which suddenly revolution isn't this sort of far-off dream on the horizon. It suddenly became part of everyday life. And I think in trying to understand what that process looked like on the ground, we have to rethink what we mean by the word revolution. Because so often we talk about capital R revolution, the seizing of state power.
Sure.
And that's when the revolution happens. But I think there's so many ways in which there are smaller transformations, in which people stand up to the boss for the first time, in which people organize their neighbors and collectively carry out an action to occupy land and start building their homes and building a new community. These are really radical transformations in the ways in which people conceive of themselves, in the ways in which they conceive of their place in society. And so what happened in Chile in that 1,000 days of the Popular Unity government are many what I call everyday revolutions, transformations in how people saw their place in society and saw an opening to act, and they took it. And in some ways, I think these smaller scale transformations are a lot less threatening than that specter of armed insurrection, than the bearded ones in the mountains or the scruffy college students building bombs in the cities. These are the sort of images we think of when we imagine Latin American revolutionaries. A housewife we don't often think of as a revolutionary, right? A sort of peasant farmer doesn't always seem like the sort of revolutionary imagery that we have. But as people really came together to try to transform their daily realities, those transformations challenge the status quo, challenge the sort of de facto powers that had really been held by that sort of traditional landed business elite in Chile. And so they were a threat to the status quo, not in the sort of terrorist guerrilla subversion that they were subsequently painted as, but in the ways in which they were claiming a life with greater dignity, a life in which they felt like equals in society.
We're speaking earlier about the Revolutionary Left Movement, or MIR, this group that was on the left of the left. What relationship did it have to the Popular Unity government, and how did it involve itself in these everyday life transformations that you're just alluding to?
So the revolutionary left, the MIR, never joined Allende's Popular Unity Coalition, although one of their national leaders, Andrés Pascal Allende, was Allende's nephew, and so there was a sort of close personal connection and communication. Typically, the MIR was sort of painted as the extremist left that was sort of a thorn in the side of Allende's ability to govern. And part of what my book, Beyond the Vanguard, looks at is the ways in which the MIR really was sort of more of an ally to the struggle, more of an ally in the sense of trying to work alongside these popular sectors. There are times, quite paradoxically, where the MIR was sort of called in to try to contain demands, to try to channel them sort of more in line with Allende's new housing policy or more in line with his new agrarian policy, rather than constantly just sort of stimulating greater and greater actions with no sort of regard for the impact they would have on his ability to govern.
Which is part of the mythology, and we'll talk about that later, but that because they were part of demands for moving more quickly, seizing land, and pushing the speed of changes faster. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So again, I think there was a kind of classic debate about revolution is how fast you go. Do you move as quickly as possible and try to consolidate your hold on power by consolidating those revolutionary changes? Or do you sort of go step by step? Allende was very much committed to working within Chile's institutional system, working within Chile's constitution. And at a certain point in time, there is a sort of contradiction of Chile's constitution was not written to benefit the working class. Right? It was a sort of bourgeois document built to reinforce the power of those who already had it. And so, I mean, part of, I think, what the Chilean experiment with socialism illustrates are the real kind of limits of liberal capitalist democracy to respond to people's needs, and what happens when more and more people have a stake in the process and they want to demand something of it, and to what extent can a democratic system open up and be responsive, and what's the breaking point?
You studied the left-wing city of Concepcion, which is not the center, certainly not the capital city, but has a radical tradition. As workers in that city threw themselves into this process to challenge the powers that be that existed, what forces of reaction were apparent there and elsewhere in the country? Because obviously, to upend things, is going to also produce a backlash, which, of course, we're so well aware of because it's hard to look at this history without being aware of the 17 years of mm-hmm. dictatorship that followed it.
So one of the sort of key points of confrontation, really in the second year of Allende's government, throughout the first year he's in power in sort of 1970-71, his government was actually quite successful at carrying out its policies, its promised reforms, and the opposition really had not been particularly vocal. But starting in 1972, they launch what was called the bosses' lockout. And that's a pretty unique thing. We think about workers going on strike, but we don't often think about bosses locking people out of being able to go to work. And this was part of a strategy really to bring the Chilean economy to the standstill. And now, thanks to the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C., we have all of the documents detailing the U.S. government's role in promoting this kind of policy, the sort of direct order from Richard Nixon to, quote unquote, make the economy scream that was given within days of Allende being elected in September 1970. And so by 1972, 2 years on, you see the sort of accumulated effect of those policies. And this was a trucker's strike. Chile is a very long, narrow country that relies on roads to connect and distribute goods throughout the country. And so in places like Concepcion, I chart how everyday people respond to this challenge of consumption, how basic consumption really became the new sort of front lines for this confrontation. And so—
And by that, do you mean shortages?
Shortages, right. So there were, one of the classic memories or images of the Allende years are waiting in line, of there not being sugar, of there not being oil, of there just being rationing and shortages for things. And a lot of those shortages, as we now know, were artificially created. Shopkeepers decided, even as Allende's sort of Keynesian economic policies had effectively increased workers' wages, the sort of irony of people say, we never had more money in our pockets, but there was nothing to buy. Shopkeepers decided to take products off the shelf and sell them at higher profits on the black market rather than producing more for the growing consumer demand that Allende had created through his policies.
And was that a political decision to destabilize?
It was. It was a political decision aimed specifically to destabilize Allende's regime, or Allende's government. And so you again see the extent to which both sort of sectors opposed to Allende in the Chilean Congress, as well as business elites, are willing to undermine the stability of an entire political system, undermine the functioning of an economy just to oppose the sitting president. And I think those are the kinds of policies that, you know, echo still today, right? To look at what are the long-term costs of delegitimizing a political system to the extent that it no longer works, that it can no longer function. Allende's administration would pass a law to fund something, and then Congress would never appropriate the money to actually fund it. So people do start to get frustrated because they feel like they've been promised so much. But again, it's the extent to which people can say, it's not Allende's fault that things aren't getting funded. It's Congress who's not doing anything. It's Congress who's throwing up roadblocks left and right. And so one of the sort of iconic images of the Allende year are waiting in lines. But in one of these lines, a worker has a sort of large poster that says, under this government, I have to wait in a line, but I support this government because it's mine. And I think that really captures the sense that people were aware that the opposition to Allende's government was what was undermining him, not his own incompetence, not the left's own incompetence. And yes, there were inefficiencies and obstacles or challenges to governability, but it really was the sort of concerted effort by the economic and political forces opposed to Allende, alongside the sort of military and sort of different actions by the U.S. government that really were effectively blocking Allende's ability to carry out his policies the way that he had promised.
What was the sense at the time of the degree to which the U.S. was involving itself in undermining Allende's government? This is obviously prior to the coup.
I think most people knew. And a part of this was because there was this sort of scandal broke in 1972 that the Chilean subsidiary of ITT, which today is AT&T, had effectively lobbied the CIA to intervene and to fund money to sort of different kind of renegade military factions in Chile to try to keep Allende out of office in that sort of brief two-month window between when he was elected in September of 1970 and when he was sworn in November. And so, you know, kind of it was fairly common knowledge that despite the public declarations by the White House that they were neutral about Chile or that they had no official oppositional stance to him, I think a lot of people knew that behind the scenes, the CIA as well as the White House were actively opposed to Allende.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Marian Schlotterbeck about her book, Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile. That's published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. It looks at the three-year period in which Allende's popular unity government attempted to establish socialism through electoral means in Chile before being overthrown in 1973. Marian Schlotterbeck is assistant professor of history at UC Davis, and I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. I wanted to ask you more about how it looked on the ground, how the transformations that people tried to enact during this period, what they look like, especially as it relates to popular democracy and democracy from the grassroots. Can you describe some examples of what this looked like?
So in Concepción province, the sort of industrial southern city, there was a long tradition of participatory democracy. Student politics at the University of Concepción really were driven by the sort of assembly-based model. And in the late 1960s, there's a massive university reform movement, and that's part of what kind of catapults this newly created revolutionary left, the MIR, onto the sort of national scene. And so there's a kind of participatory democratic practice coming out of the university. There's a similar kind of participatory democratic practice in the shantytown movement, where urban homeless poor would form committees. They would debate kind of what possibilities existed for unoccupied lands that they could, you know, in a very concerted, carefully, these weren't spontaneous ad hoc movements. These were carefully planned. Months of planning would go into one of these massive urban land invasions. And then they'd be governed by a general assembly of pobladores, of the sort of urban poor. So there are different kind of participatory democratic practices that existed in this region. And in this moment of Allende's government, there was an effort to really scale those up to the regional level. And so one of the chapters in the book details the Concepción People's Assembly, which took place in July 1972, and really was this effort to sort of allow a space for grassroots social leaders as well as party activists to come together and debate what future path should the revolution go down? Is there a way in which people's participation can actually be institutionalized and not just be the sort of mouthpiece that it actually often was, right? I think the left in Chile, you know, in the 60s, in the language of the 60s, you know, very much wanted the masses to mobilize, but they didn't always want the masses to be driving the bus, right? They wanted them to be listening at the political rallies, not writing the proposals and declarations. And so in this sort of student labor center of Concepción in 1972, there was an effort to really create a space for those voices to be heard. And that's sort of what one of the chapters in the book is about and illustrates just sort of how fraught that process was, sort of how do you institute popular democracy in the midst of a revolution.
It's interesting. One of the things that you explore in your book, Beyond the Vanguard, and the resonance in the title of your book speaks to this, that the revolutionary left movement, or MIR, which was playing an important role in a lot of this grassroots upheaval, that ideologically it was a very top-down Leninist organization, as were many radical social movements of the era. And yet, despite that ideology, and the self-projection of the organization, you argue that its practice turned out to be much more complex. How so?
So I think it's almost kind of in spite of its Marxist-Leninist ideology, the mirror on the ground succeeded. And that has a lot to do with this tradition of a leftist working class culture in Concepcion that comes out of the labor movement that was very active in the 1930s and 40s during the Popular Front. And so I think part of what made the mirror successful were the local people on the ground who joined its ranks. Right? So often I think the mirror in Chile and other revolutionary left groups in Latin America kind of get written off as these sort of fringy student groups that just want to debate ideology, or that are all talk and no action. And so part of what I think makes Chile's revolutionary left under Allende such an interesting case study is that it was more than just talk. It really became, at least in the southern industrial province of Concepcion, a grassroots movement for revolution instead of just the sort of top-down vanguard. And how that happened is the ways in which it was able to articulate a project for radical political transformation alongside people's everyday struggles, and the ways in which as more and more people joined the movement, they were able to influence its orientation.
How did that movement and allied movements respond to the mounting forces of reaction, which you said were sort of delayed, in fact, but come 1972, there's the bosses' lockout. How did these grassroots revolutionaries feel this sort of mounting reaction should be countered, and how was Allende countering them?
So I think at the grassroots, there was really a strong demand to just go out and stop these actions, particularly in this southern province of Concepcion, where the left was numerically the majority. They said in this province, the right can go march all they want in the streets of Santiago, but not here in Concepcion. And so we see examples of, going out and occupying a bakery and saying that the bakery needs to produce good bread for everyone, not just selling the higher quality bread at higher prices to the people in the cities, but to actually make it accessible to the coal miners and their families in the town where this bakery was located. Allende has a much harder time, right? Because he's governing. He has to find a way out of this sort of stalemate. And at the time, the more radical leftist sectors of his coalition said, throw your weight behind these grassroots movements. Other sectors of the Communist Party, which was actually much more moderate within the left in Chile, said, it's time to keep trying to negotiate with the middle, keep negotiating with the Christian Democrats, negotiate a solution out of this. And so Allende actually brings in two military figures into his cabinet as part of the negotiated sort of exit from the stalemate over the boss's lockout. Part of, I think, the sort of challenge for Allende was that the center increasingly wasn't there. The center had moved closer and closer to the right, and eventually the Christian Democrats, the majority of the party, throw their support behind the authoritarian right and a military solution. And so Allende's left at the negotiation table really without a sort of good faith negotiating partner to try to find a real solution to the sort of stalemate that Chile was at by late 1972.
So Allende's government was overthrown on September 11th, 1973. In the months leading up to that, was it apparent that such an authoritarian solution was in the offing?
I think many people thought a coup was coming. It really, I think, seemed apparent that Allende was not going to be able to finish his six-year term in office in 1976. I think very few Chileans really had any sense of just how violent and brutal the military repression would be. I mean, even the Christian Democrats, who really welcomed the coup coming to power, I think thought within a couple months it would be their turn to be president again. And they were sadly mistaken as well. And so I just think the sheer scale of violence that was unleashed, not just against Allende and members of his government, but really against Chilean society as a whole, against all those sectors of society, the workers, the peasants, the mother centers, the shantytown residents, the students who'd been mobilized to support Allende, but also really just mobilized to be a part of society, to be a sort of active force in the broader democratization of Chilean political life. The military really targeted their repression against all those sectors, not just the sort of highest level political leaders and Allende himself.
Well, how did they try to wipe out not just the networks and the movements, but also kind of the remnants of memory and of opposition in a country that had been so mobilized and so politicized and where mass movements were very much part of everyday life?
I mean, the first way in which the military made its presence felt was through violent repression. And so there's sort of mass scale arrests and detentions in the days and weeks following the coup. And those then pivot with the creation of the secret police force towards a sort of targeted execution, the detention and disappearance of leftist political militants. The revolutionary left MIR foremost amongst them, but then also the socialists and communists and other leftist groups as well. So there's the sort of targeted effort to eliminate these groups from Chile. And I think part of what makes Chile's experience with dictatorship and repression a bit different from other Latin American countries, like Argentina, for instance, is the number of Chileans who actually survived the clandestine torture centers. So official Truth Commission reports acknowledge 3,200 Chilean citizens were executed or murdered by the regime, but 38,000 were political prisoners who survived detention and torture. And another estimates of 100,000 experienced sort of shorter detention periods and mass raids on their working class communities. And so that level of, I think, didactic violence, of the fact that, you know, many people had people missing from their communities or from their families, that there were survivors of this brutal violence, really worked to instill a culture of fear. And I think the level of violence with time also meant that many Chileans started to believe some of the kind of fake news or some of the kind of narratives that the regime propagated about why this was necessary. People needed a kind of narrative to make sense of why this was happening. And so with time, they started to believe that some of these leftist groups hadn't just been the local school teacher or the local mayor or the baker. They'd actually been part of these subversive terrorist elements because it must be for something. And I think, you know, that culture of fear really worked its way into the fabric of Chilean society during 17 years of military dictatorship. It's much longer than most of the other militaries were in power in South America at this time.
Why do you think it was the case that the repression of the popular unity government and the experience was so massive, so thorough, and so long?
I think one reason why it was so intense is because of the project that the popular unity government represented. I mean, in so many ways, Augusto Pinochet is a much more iconic Latin American dictator than any of the Argentine military generals in the junta. Right? Argentina had a six-year dictatorship that sort of took over from a kind of unstable political situation under Isabel Perón. And so I think a lot of attention was focused on Chile, particularly the sort of solidarity and human rights movement, because of all of the sort of hope and expectation that had been put on Allende's government. I think part of the sort of longevity of Pinochet's term in office really came from his ability to pivot from outright repression, which in other cases, like Argentina, the military kind of founders on itself and isn't able to sort of hold power when they have a disastrous war against Great Britain over the Falkland Islands. By contrast, Pinochet really by 1979 pivots away from violent repression to try to institutionalize his political and economic projects. And that's where you have the sort of influence of the famous Chicago Boys, the Chilean economists trained at the University of Chicago under Milton Friedman, who see this opportunity of this authoritarian political regime in which there's no possibility for political dissent to implement a lot of their top-down austerity measures, the so-called sort of shock doctrine, shock treatment to the Chilean economy. And so it's both a sort of existence of this group of economic thinkers who see a political opportunity to really experiment with the Chilean economy and to radically transform Chilean society in the process.
That's Marian Schlotterbeck. We're talking about Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, it appears that, and as you've been arguing, that part of Pinochet's agenda during those 17 years of dictatorship is to rewrite history and to kind of obliterate the memory of the popular unity government and the left grassroots movements that had supported it, obviously partly by killing the revolutionaries who had been involved in them, but also rewriting history literally to particularly put the blame on the organization that you've been talking about, the revolutionary left movement, that they went too far, they pushed Allende too much to the left, and very bad things happened, which really needs to be laid at their feet. Looking back now, from this vantage point, and trying to be aware, as you do in your book, of how it's very hard to see these 3 years of the popular unity period without the 17 years of dictatorship that followed. How do you assess that claim that the revolutionary left movement was to blame?
I think part of what that narrative that casts Latin American leftist revolutionaries as idealistic young people who became sort of victims of state violence through their misguided idealism, or the more, I think, sort of stringent right-wing interpretation that says these were the provocateurs of violence. They asked for it, and they got a taste of their own medicine, and all of society got swept up in the mix. And I think those narratives really are much more about justifying the ongoing political repression, justifying the ongoing effects of economic austerity. And for so long, it really wasn't possible to go back and revisit kind of who were these young revolutionaries? What were they trying to accomplish? How did they accomplish it? Why did people want to join these movements? And why did people who weren't just college students want to join these movements? And so that's, I think, in large part where I really started this book, is sort of trying to understand who joined, what they did, and how they actually spent most of their time. And I think that's an important project to ask about the 1960s more broadly. I think we've seen an incredible wave of new scholarship about Black Power and the Black Panther Party, even right here in Oakland, looking at part of what made those movements successful was about how they created social programs that had a positive impact on communities, on children, on women, on sort of ordinary people. And that asks us to look beyond the often very carefully, consciously self-cultivated image of revolutionary masculinity and the sort of main leaders of these movements to really understand who were the people, who was the rank and file actually doing this work, and what made it meaningful for them. And so I think part of why I was motivated to do this project was to really look at this group in Chile that had been scapegoated for 17 years, for more than 17 years, well into the sort of 90s and the 2000s, that this was sort of not seen as a group that was worth studying or that it was safe to talk about, because for so long, people had had to keep their participation a secret. And so part of what I see this book as doing is just opening up the opportunity for these grassroots activists to talk about what they saw as their project, what had motivated them to be a part of this movement, and let the readers decide for themselves sort of what kind of a threat they pose to society.
Well, trying to take stock of these movements and their successes and failures. At the time of the popular unity government, there was a great deal of support internationally from the left of what was happening in Chile. What lessons do you think did the Latin American left take away from the crushing of this electoral revolution, if we can call it that? Do you think that it reinforced the notion that armed struggle was the only way?
I mean, it certainly does if you look at Central America in the 70s and the 80s, right? I mean, even I think Fidel Castro was quite clear that the problem was Allende wasn't as forceful enough in silencing his opposition, right? That the problem is how do you work with an opposition that's not willing to play by the rules of the democratic game? And I think, you know, of all the criticisms that people could make of Allende, he was really the true Democrat who worked within the system, who believed in the Constitution, who believed in Chile's political system as the means to resolve conflicts. So I do think there is a sort of, certainly for sectors allied with the Cuban Revolution and the sort of next iteration of the Sandinistas coming to power in Nicaragua in 1979 and guerrilla struggle in Guatemala, as well as in El Salvador, you do see the foreclosing of moderate centrist options as polarizing society and really quite quickly convincing people that taking up arms is the only way to oppose an unjust social order.
Looking back, though, when you assess the limitations to the project of popular democracy under the popular unity government, and obviously history plays out in different ways, and that's not preordained, but nonetheless, do you think it tells us something about the limits to what kind of change can happen in a, you know, ostensibly liberal democratic society?
I think this case study on Chile under Allende in the 1970s really highlights the tensions and these unresolved questions about what avenues really exist for citizens to participate in a democracy beyond a voting in elections every 4 years, what platforms exist for their voices to be heard. It also speaks to the tensions between the relationship between social movements and political parties. To what extent are political parties sort of co-opting and controlling social movements? To what extent can social movements really remain kind of outside institutional channels and be effective at pressuring and sort of changing the conversation more broadly within a society? So I think what is so fascinating about this case study is the ways in which the questions about democratization, about social change in the 1960s, were not answered at the time. These sort of radical social and political movements highlighted these tensions. They challenged the political system. They challenged the political system to democratize, to really open up and transform kind of from this pressure from below. And the military takeover didn't resolve those questions. It simply repressed them and in some ways kind of kicked the can down the road. Right? Because when you see the transitions back to democracy in Latin America in the 80s and 90s, it's the moment of neoliberalism, of economic austerity measures that have effectively severed a lot of the older means for participation and representation that people had in democracy in the first half of the 20th century. So at this point in time, political parties often don't have a lot of popular support. People don't feel represented or identified with them. And so I think that's part of why you see this resurgence of very vibrant social movements in Chile and elsewhere that are really bringing these questions of people's legitimate demands back onto the table and asking, if not through institutional means, maybe through the streets, can people's voices really be heard?
Well, let me end by asking you about continuity and rupture. In 2011, there was a mass movement that broke out in Chile, populated by students and others, that denounced neoliberal austerity. One of the things that's striking in reading Beyond the Vanguard is the ways that past movements feed into future ones throughout Chile's history, at least in the 20th century. And so the militancy from below, the popular militancy of the 30s and 40s, then continues a kind of life in later movements in the 1960s, even if some of those movements ideologically may seem more top-down, but there's a continuity. But then you have a moment, and it's not just a moment, it lasts 17 years, of tremendous rupture, of an attempt to erase all memory or to rewrite history altogether. And so people who were involved in the movements of the early 1970s on the left are fearful to even mention that history and discuss it. You actually were in Chile in 2011 when this mass upsurge happened. How did that movement, broadly speaking, relate to the history that you've written about of the 1,000 days of the Allende Popular Unity Government in the 1970s? Is there any sense of drawing from that history? Is that history known?
I mean, the student movement of 2011 very broadly responded to the neoliberal austerity measures and the privatization of education. That's a legacy of dictatorship. So in terms of what they were directly challenging, that comes out of the dictatorship. But so often this generation of young people in Chile are called the generation without fear, because they were born after 1990, after the end of dictatorship. And so I think really for the first time you saw in their repertoire of creative protest tactics, of occupying the streets with sort of theatricality, of occupying their schools, you saw a return to political mobilization as centered around joy and liberation. And I think that taps into this deeper historical memory of what everyday Chileans experienced in that 1,000 days of revolution, that feeling of making history, of being part of a broader movement. And I think, you know, beyond sort of clear intergenerational connections, say grandparents from the 60s generation talking to their grandchildren who were part of the contemporary student movement, I think you can see connections in the ways in which people are transformed by engaging in movement politics. And those transformations aren't maybe even best measured by the immediate political outcomes from a movement, because it often takes decades to really assess what impact social movements have on their ability to transform society. And so I think there are clear parallels in terms of scale and effervescence and the desire to seek out new forms of political action that bridge that 60s generation with the contemporary student movement today.
Thank you, Marian.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Marian Schlotterbeck. She's assistant professor of history at UC Davis. We've been discussing her book, Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile. That's published by UC Press, and you can find it on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.